You're listening to Well Made, a podcast from Lumi about the future of e-commerce. I'm your host, Stefan Ango. Heidi Zak, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So Heidi, you're the co-founder and CEO of Third Love. Third Love is a direct-to-consumer bra company, or underwear as a whole now?
Yes, I would say bra and underwear company.
And you co-founded the company about 4 or 5 years ago at this point?
Yep, that's right. It's coming up on 5.5 years.
Wow. And you started this with your husband, is that correct?
That's right. At the time, I was at Google and he was at Sequoia at the VC firm. And we were both coming up with different business ideas at home at night when we get home late, 8 p.m., 9 p.m. So for, I would say, a good 6 months, we were toying around with a lot of different business ideas, not thinking that we were actually going to do it together. We were kind of going down our own paths. And then at one point, I had this idea on bras in particular, and he was looking at things in the e-commerce space. And I, of course, he didn't really know a lot about bras in the bra market, but once he started doing research on it, he realized how big of an opportunity there was with this, you know, one big player, Victoria's Secret, owning 50% of the market. And that's really how we came to join forces. And we started in our living room, and it's been a crazy journey. Now we're well over 200 people, and it's, it's been a crazy ride.
Well, it's interesting. So one of the things that makes the Third Love experience so special is that you have such a big focus on data and how that's part of the fit. Is that right? So it starts to make sense how someone from Google and someone from Sequoia start to think about how those two things relate to each other. Can you tell me a little bit more about how that works?
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head. So when I say Third Love, if I want somebody to say one word, I want them to say fit. And that's everything we do centers around that. And the reason why fit is so important in bras in particular is that bras are super complex garments. They're the most difficult garment to sew. They have over 30 components per bra, and everything is sewn by hand. So it's a very, very technical garment, and it takes a lot of skill to both design and sew the garment. And there's a lot of data that goes into that. And so what we've done is really taken a massive amount of data we've collected from customers and real women, and use that to fit every single size and style that we create. So we've really turned the industry upside down in terms of how we think about fit, how we design product, and then also how we help women find their fit, which is through our Fit Finder. It's an online fitting room, basically.
You mentioned before we started recording that you went to business school with Seth Skerritt, who is a recent guest and the founder of Proper Cloth. They have a similar approach in the world of shirts, but I've seen you also say, not to take away any credit from him, that the shirts are a lot simpler. And when you mentioned the 30 components, I'm just curious, for those who aren't intimately familiar with the construction of a bra, what are those 30 components? Sorry, maybe don't give an entire list, but how does it all come together?
I won't laundry list, but you have the cup, you have the straps, you have the elastic, you have the hook and eye, you have all of the fabric, you have the center front gore, you have the wire, you have the wire channel, and then a whole host of other fabric and elastics that go into different parts of the bra. So not only does every single component matter for the fit, but how they come together, how they're sewn. And then, of course, even the color matching is incredibly complex. And again, yeah, not to take anything away from a shirt, but we do use this example a lot. A shirt has four components, really. I mean, you have thread, buttons, and the fabric on most shirts. So the complexity of a bra is unlike any other garment. And honestly, I had no idea. When I started the company, I had no idea that there were 30 components in a bra. I had no idea how hard it was to manufacture a bra that fit. And it's been absolutely, manufacturing was a huge hurdle for us at the beginning. And most of that stemmed from the complexity of the garment.
Yeah, the only thing that I can think of that is quite as complex that most people have is something like a sneaker, but I don't even know if that's that complicated. Just the overlap of different materials and foams and metal and everything.
For sure. And I think the idea of fit is fit for shoes. Shoes can be as uncomfortable as a bra when you have the wrong size on or the wrong style. So if you've ever, and it's a good analogy for a guy who doesn't wear a bra, but if you've ever put on a pair of shoes that are incredibly uncomfortable and you're cursing as you're walking in them and then you never wear them again, that's, imagine having a bra on like that. I mean, that's the equivalent. And it's also interesting with shoes. One of the innovations in the shoe market in America over the past 100 years was the addition of a half size to shoes. So if you think about European shoe sizing, it is a kind of a whole size. And one of the things we've done in the US was create half sizes to give a better fit. And that's actually something we've done with our bras at Third Love, is offer this half size cup for in between the traditional cup sizes. And that's something that's really allowed us to provide a better fit in our bras than any other brand out there.
So when you talk about the data that you're collecting, what is this sort of information and how does it actually feed into the way that you design the bra compared to, I mean, I presume the way that they've been designed up until now is using models and people and forms that are fitted. How does that differ?
Yeah. So one of my most interesting memories from the early days was when we went to create our first bra in our first style. And we had no data at that point because we were just starting out. We had no customers. We had no product. We had no website. So there we are in New York City using a fit model who cost, I think, $300 an hour, $250 or $300 an hour. And her name was Dorothy. And she was the 34B fit model. And she was, I think at the time in her 50s, she's actually just recently retired over the past few years. And so we were with her and she was fitting the bra. And I turned to my head of design, who was our first hire. She's a lingerie, a technical lingerie designer. And I said, this is crazy. How are we fitting on this one woman to create a 34B for millions of women who have very different body types from Dorothy? They could be taller. They could be shorter. They could be many, many different things. And Rael said, well, this is sort of the way it's always been done, but that's a really good point. And when we went back to San Francisco, we decided we would never use fit models again, that it didn't make any sense. So from the very beginning, I think we had our eyes open and we're approaching it in a different way to say, it shouldn't be a one person impacting millions of women. It should be many, many women, many body types impacting fit. And so from that point in time, what we started doing is two things. One, we started using real women to be fit models. So every size that you can think of are part of our focus groups in San Francisco and across the country. And we really use real women with multiple size of breasts and body shapes and heights to fit all of our product. That's one thing that we do differently. And the second is we've collected a massive amount of data. So we have had over 8 million women complete our fit finder. And through that, we learn a lot about fit issues, breast shape, the recommended size through our algorithm that we're providing. And then we can have a really strong feedback loop that ties back into the product. So we use that information to impact product development down to the individual size. And so that's what's really different. If you think about traditional retail, you have one fit model and then a brand grades up or down from the 34B or from the medium. And they just say, what's a small going to be? What's a large going to be? And for us, we don't do that. We look at each size. So if it's a 36E or a 34AA or a 34G, we look at each size individually and figure out what the specs are for that size and style. So it's a very nuanced approach to product development and fitting.
So among the 8 million women, I think I might have been one of those people. I filled out your survey or
so,
your questionnaire.
So do you have asymmetric breasts or what,
well,
what did you think?
You know, I just wanted to learn how it all works. And, you know, I definitely learned some new terms. But I forget. I may have actually picked asymmetric. It was interesting to fill it out just to kind of get an idea of how the whole system works. And I noticed that, first of all, I'm not sure how many questions there are, but it's like a dozen or more questions. Mm-hmm. And I was just personally curious from a user experience standpoint, how often you change those questions. Like how did you get to that set of questions?
That's a great question. Constant testing and iteration, and not everyone sees the same questions. Mm. So over time, we've been able to determine based on what somebody might answer what are the other questions we should be asking. And so there's definitely nuances within the Fit Finder based on the algorithm we've developed where you would see different questions based on your fit issue, for example, or potentially your breast shape. But it's been an evolution. To start off with, what we did was really take the expertise of a fitting room, what would happen in a traditional fitting room, right, where you're getting fit for a bra. What the woman is generally doing is she's kind of sizing up your breast shape, your body type, and many of the things that we've brought to life through our Fit Finder. So we basically digitize that. And then there's a massive amount of testing and iteration that occurs because any little tweak we make to both the question or the output can dramatically change what we're recommending. And so it's a constantly evolving platform, but obviously the more data that goes in, the smarter it gets. So at this point, we've really fine-tuned it. The changes that are occurring now are much smaller than they were at the beginning.
Yeah. I'm going to draw an analogy that's probably not going to make sense to everyone, but Ken Tomita, who is the founder of Grove Made, was on our show a few weeks ago, and he talked about how the first product that he ever developed was an iPhone case from one of the first iPhones that had a very, if you remember that phone, it had like a complex curve. It wasn't just a flat back. It was a curve that was rounded in multiple direction and like ellipse around the shape in every direction. And you're dealing, I'm an industrial designer by nature. So when I think about like how to model a three-dimensional complex curve that's got shapes in every direction, that's a really complicated thing. And I noticed in the questionnaire that the way that you think about that is not by asking people to like actually measure things with like a measuring tape. You're saying, how's your current bra fitting? What are the areas that are sagging? What are the areas that are too tight? And try to adjust from there. So it seems like you've developed also quite a good knowledge of the existing products out there and how those map to your products. Is that making sense? Yeah. Is that true?
Yeah. And I mean, look, in an ideal world, of course, you'd have an exact measurement from a customer, right? But there's literally probably 1% of the population that can efficiently measure themselves with a measuring tape. I'm certainly not one of them. It's really hard to measure yourself. It's really hard to know where to place it and how to exactly measure. And when you're off, you're way off. And so what we learned was there's so much that you can learn from what somebody's wearing and what the fit issues that they have are, and all of the nuances of their individual shape. And so, yeah, it's been a learning process, but absolutely, like we're really focused on something that's also easy for somebody to understand and relate to and complete. That's hugely important as well.
And people change too, over time. How do you deal with that?
We recommend for our customers that they redo the Fit Finder usually once a year, but anytime you have a life change, the average woman changes bra sizes at minimum 6 times over the course of her life.
Wow.
So that's a substantial amount. But absolutely, if you've had weight loss or gain, if you've recently had children, anything like that, that would absolutely impact what you need to look and feel your best, for sure.
Again, these are very maybe dumb questions, but did you ever consider doing some sort of like 3D scan of like different, because I know they do that in like ear shapes and stuff like that for headphones. Have you thought about that?
It's funny you ask. We actually did that originally. So when we launched in 2014, we had an app that used computer vision technology that we developed internally. And through taking 2 photos, we were able to create a 3D model and approximate the circumference of both the underbust and overbust, which is what you need to calculate bra size. And what we learned over time was that I think, one, we were ahead of the curve and it was a little bit too techy for the average, mm-hmm. kind of the average user. And second, not everybody is super comfortable using a photo or video to calculate their bra size. It's obviously like a sensitive part of the body. And For us, what we decided to do was kind of pivot from that into the Fit Finder, which was something that, you know, 99% of people can easily complete. And I think there's a lot of opportunity to still innovate on that in the future. And there's a lot going on in the space, but it has to be really, really easy and seamless for people to want to use it.
Yeah, I think that idea has come up a lot. I remember, I think Warby Parker used to have a thing where you could, you know, test out frames digitally. And I think they've sort of lessened the importance of that part of their software. Recently, though, you know, Apple has released a lot of new, and Google, like a lot of new augmented reality technology. I've seen some cool things that IKEA has done that helps you like see what this thing could be, you know, this piece of furniture could look like in your apartment. But it does seem like that all that stuff is maybe a little far out still. It's not quite there yet. And it's a lot of work to develop something like that if not many people are going to use it.
Exactly. And I think for any startup and a company with limited funds, right, is that you have to pick and choose how you're going to spend your money and your time. And so, yes, absolutely. I think it's all a balance of like picking the things where you feel like you're going to make the biggest impact the most quickly.
So going back to, you know, starting the company and coming from Google, what was your role at Google? And are there things that you took from Google into Third Love?
Yeah. So my role at Google, I reported to the VP of marketing, and I worked on some small business initiatives and really trying to bring Google products together so your average small business owner could really understand the offerings. For me, being at Google and a tech company was completely new. So after business school at MIT, actually, I did my summer internship at Aeropostale in New York, and then I went there after business school, and I was there, I think, close to 4 years, and I launched and ran new businesses there, including their international division. And that was a really amazing experience. And when I moved to the West Coast, I was debating, should I go into tech? Should I do something in the retail space? And I decided to do something different, which was go to Google. So I never worked for a tech company. I learned so much when I was there. I was only there 2 years, but the pace of change and innovation and sort of the culture that Google has created and still has is really, really amazing, even at the scale that they're at. And, you know, for me at Google, I think one of the biggest things I learned is that this idea that change and doing something new all the time is actually exciting. So what happened to me was I took this job, and I took a job. Originally, I was supposed to be working with retail companies because I had this retail background. And so call it 2 to 3 months into Google, I get called into a room and they're like, oh, we completely reorged. You're going to take on this new role. And I went home that night and my head was spinning. I'm thinking to myself, I have no idea what I'm doing. They completely got rid of this role that I originally accepted. I was completely stressed out about it. And I was talking to my husband, and he said, take a chance that this could create something even better than what you were working on before and be open to that. And I went back in the next day, and I really tried to have this new outlook, and it was true. I think the new opportunity that was presented to me and what I ended up doing was even better than the first one. And Google really taught me that embracing change and the pace of change, innovation happens from change. So as I say to people in our team at Third Love, if you're not feeling like we're changing and that you're changing, then we're doing something wrong, because change is what creates innovation. And so for me, that was a big learning at Google, and something that is a core value at Third Love is constantly pushing ourselves to adapt and change on a daily basis.
Yeah. It's also interesting that your husband saw that potential as well and was interested in e-commerce, because it's hard to put ourselves back in that place 5 years ago, or, you know, 5.5 years ago. The model, the direct-to-consumer model, was, you know, still evolving.
Infancy.
Yeah, still in its infancy. Today, I think that investors are much more likely to take that seriously. But back then, it was a different world, and raising money and getting that idea off the ground must have been a little more challenging than it might have been today.
Absolutely. I mean, I reflect back to 5.5 years ago and what companies were out there. There was pretty much, I think it was Rent the Runway, Birchbox, Gilt. That was kind of the landscape. And today, of course, there's a direct-to-consumer business in every single vertical out there that we could name, probably. So the increase in entrants over the past 2 years has been massive, which is awesome, right? Because every sector should be disrupted and there's so much opportunity. So it's a very exciting time. Back then there weren't very many comps. And in fact, the e-commerce companies out there were not vertically integrated. I guess Warby had just launched. So, it's never easy to raise money, and it's certainly not easy to raise money in a category that men don't use or wear. So when you're, you know, pitching to men 98% of the time, it's the pitch changes and the way you talk about it changes. So it's never easy, but I think it's, you have to know your audience and solve for that when you're creating your pitch, and you learn to do that quickly if you want to succeed.
Yeah, and I think that just e-commerce as a category for a long time wasn't as attractive, I think, to investors, because it's, the returns are not as crazy mm-hmm. as something like Facebook or something like that, which is pure software. As soon as you introduce the physical element and having inventory and those kind of things, it becomes a different equation. So I'm actually, I don't know if you can speak for David, but do you know, from his perspective, coming from that world where they presumably weren't looking at a lot of e-commerce companies, what was his fascination with it?
So one of the investments he had made at Sequoia was Stella and Dot. And I think that investment really showed the power of female purchasing power and also the community involved with referring a product to friends. Now Stella and Dot is a MLM model, so it's a bit different, but still it is the voice of women kind of connecting and talking that creates the community that has built Stella and Dot's business into what it is today. And so I think he really saw a lot of potential there. And then the second piece that he had really brought up to me was, there's a lot of e-commerce at the time, a lot of these e-commerce companies that he was seeing kind of come through the door were focused on men. And because most founders are men. And so it's a natural inclination that you start something that you can use, right? And you're solving your distinct need. And when you look at the landscape of consumer purchasing power, women spend 70% of the dollars. So inherently, just there seem to be missing pieces in the landscape. So his fascination was really around women-focused e-commerce companies, because he felt like that there was a big hole there. And there absolutely is. And in fact, you look at Victoria's Secret, for example, you know, it's run by men, and men don't wear bras. So, you know, who's better suited to innovate in a category? It's somebody who actually wears and uses the product. Our company is over 80% female. So it is really a company that is for women by women. And I think that that's a big differentiator in the space.
In the beginning, you were also experimenting with retail distribution, or where is that at, or what's your relationship with that side of things?
Yeah, so in the early days, we partnered with Bloomingdale's, and at the time, you know, our brand wasn't as well known, and we felt like the Bloomingdale's partnership could really help us reach some customers. And also, if the Bloomingdale's buyers love Third Love and they put it in store, then it says something about our brand and our product quality and our fit. And so we did that partnership for about 2 years, and then it just became such a small part of our business. And we realized there was really an inability to affect the customer journey in the way we wanted to. And it's hugely important for me to feel like we are giving the best service we can possible to each and every customer who comes to Third Love. So who comes to our website, who chats with our fit stylists, anybody that we interact with, we really, really, that's our goal, is to help women. And so you lose that piece of the relationship with the customer when you're partnering with someone else. And so about a year ago, we ended that relationship. It didn't make sense for us anymore, as the brand had really taken off and we had a large amount of scale.
Yeah. Well, there's something interesting that I think Zappos, as a we mentioned shoes before, we mentioned Warby Parker, you know, both of those products like bras are things that you really feel like you have to try on before you can make a decision. So I'm assuming that you've found similar mechanisms that they have for making returns really easy. And you mentioned before we started recording that you're starting to think about what a showroom might be like. What are your strategies for helping people figure out that fit in the real world?
Yeah, that is the number one question for anybody selling direct to consumer. It's, you know, you can talk about your product, you can show videos of it, you can do many, many things online. But let's be honest, that nothing replaces touching and feeling a product. There has been no solve for that up until today. So therein lies the big question and hurdle for most companies selling online. It's like, how do you explain what makes your product great? And that nearly killed us as a business. In fact, if we didn't figure out what we did, we wouldn't be here today. There was a moment in time where we were really, really struggling with how we communicated, how comfortable our bras were, and how we would get women to try them. And we came up with this radical idea. It was in 2015, so probably 3 years ago. And we said, how about we actually let a woman wear the bra and not have to pay for it? We'll just send it to her for free. She can take the tags off and actually wear it for 30 days and make sure it's her new favorite bra. And if she doesn't love it, she takes the tags off and she sends it back to us. Because that's really saying, I believe in this product so much that you can, there's no other business that lets you do this. If you think about it, what other business lets you not pay for something and then use it and then decide whether or not you want to keep it? I think you're hard pressed to probably come up with any apparel company that lets you do that. And so that was a, you know, a big, big change for us as a business to create this try before buying program and really make it less risky, right, for somebody to try us out. And so it's amazing. There's so many customers that I meet who are like, oh my God, you're the founder of Third Love. I love your bras. I did the try before buying program because I was just like, what do I have to lose, right? You know, if this bra's not as great as they say, then I'll send it back. And so I think it's really, really important for anybody selling online. How are you addressing that fear that a customer has, which is this isn't going to work for me? And free returns and exchanges obviously help, but I do think that today customers even want more than that. So it's a big, big question that we think about all the time. It's like, how are we delivering a risk-free experience for somebody trying Third Love?
You mentioned this being a really pivotal decision. And I think in those moments in time where like the survival of your company is in jeopardy, making a decision like that is really hard because obviously you're putting yourself out there. If this doesn't work, then, you know, maybe you could be losing a lot of money. So like, how did you guys actually experiment with that? Or did you just believe in the idea so much that you just launched it and it worked?
So, yeah. So basically what we had a really serious meeting at our company. And at the time we were probably 12, 15 people. We were pretty small and we brought everyone in and we said, we've got to figure out how to market our product. And in particular, we were really focused on Facebook at the time and our ads weren't working and it was $400 CPAs. I mean, it was crazy. And it's like, this isn't going to work. This is not sustainable. And if we don't figure out a way to communicate to a customer the value proposition, we will not be here in a year collectively. Third Love will not exist. And that's when you come up with crazy ideas. You have to. There is no other choice. You're either going to die or you're not, and you need to figure something out. And it sounds drastic, and it is drastic. But any founder with a company has been through not probably one moment like this, but multiple. And you have to pick something that sounds like the best option that you believe in, and then you go for it. And you hope that it turns out how you want. And look, you don't know. And a lot of companies die and a lot of things don't work. And we were fortunate enough that this program that we set up not only met our expectations, but actually exceeded them. And by the expectations, I mean, we had set up a model to say, you know, if the keep rate is X percent, we can break even on this program on the first purchase. And that is massive. And so we were closely tracking all these metrics to make sure that the program worked, and it did. And so the nice thing about Facebook is the immediacy of it. It's the fact that you put up an ad, that you start to put money behind it, and somebody clicks or they don't, somebody converts or they don't, somebody keeps the bra or they don't. And so within a month, you have a tremendous amount of data that you can work with and understand sort of whether you can scale. And so for us, it worked. And then we were able to scale in a massive way.
Did that reduce the amount of spending that you were doing on Facebook? Did it allow you to change the way you balance that out, or did you maintain the same level? It's just more informed now.
Oh, well, we went from spending not that much on Facebook to spending a massive amount on Facebook.
Oh, I see. Okay,
because it was
yeah.
effective for us, yeah. right? But what it really did, and I think what you're asking is, it really opened up a lot of other platforms for us to think about, because what we really actually did through Facebook initially, which was our first digital marketing platform, was it crystallized the offer. It crystallized who we were, what we were going to tell our customer, and this idea of the try before buying program. So from there, we quickly went on to podcasts. We started advertising on podcasts in 2015. We were one of the first brands to be on podcasts. Again, today, podcasts are a thing that many more people are aware of. In the early days, when I would tell investors we were advertising on podcasts, they said podcast question mark. Like, what do you mean? Like, what does that even mean? It's amazing that was 3 years ago. So we've had an ability to see platforms and get into them early and really scale. And that has really helped us grow tremendously as a brand. And most recently in the fall of last year, in late 2017, we started doing TV. And so now we're running TV commercials as well. And so it's very, very exciting to kind of see our value proposition and the brand work across different mediums.
TV is fascinating because presumably you get a lot less data than you do through Facebook. How do you figure out if it's working for you? Is it through discount codes and things like that as a mechanism?
No, we don't use discount codes. We use a digital tracking platform. It's pretty amazing, actually, today, the amount of data you can get from TV. You can actually get information down to a conversion level. And yes, it's not 100% accurate, but it is a substantial amount of data. So in my mind, you know, TV has as much potential, if not more, as Facebook to be a channel that we scale as well. Obviously, it's not as targeted, but the reach is immense. So there's pros and cons of every single platform out there. It's really understanding where your customer is and how you're going to reach them. We think about marketing holistically in terms of who's the third love customer? What's she doing? Who is she? What does she watch? What does she listen to? You know, how does she spend her day? And how would we reach her in multiple ways? And that's really the core. The core is really the customer.
What was the deciding factor to go into TV? What type of customer do you find there that you're not finding elsewhere?
I know it's hard to believe, but there are actually some people who don't use social media, right? It's interesting. When I talked, you know, there's definitely people that I know who they're not on Facebook, or they don't use Instagram, or, you know, they're not online all day long. That they have a certain kind of role where they're not sitting, you know, behind a computer screen, for example. And so what TV does is really, it widens the audience that you're able to reach. It could be age-based, it could be geography-based. It's much broader. And so that's what's key. As we scale as a brand, you know, these days, most people I meet know Third Love, and our brand really is out there. People know it, they've heard of it. And so how do we continue to reach more people? And TV has that reach that actually no other platform has, I would say. TV is the largest reach of any kind of platform. Still today, maybe radio as well. Radio has the same reach.
So are there any other like life-changing decisions that happened at Third Love that you can think of that really changed the course of the company that otherwise may have not survived? You mentioned there might be the most CEOs or founders might deal with a few.
Yeah, I mean the one that occurred before the try before buying initiative was really manufacturing, and we were initially manufacturing in Mexico because of NAFTA and because of proximity to. We're based in San Francisco, so there was sort of this ease of managing the factory. So I practically lived on the border of Mexico for a good 6 months, trying to figure things out with our manufacturing partner, and at some point, we just realized that it wasn't working. And this is, I reflect back and a big mistake that we made was not pulling out of Mexico sooner. We lost more money than we should have because we were afraid to walk away. And I think a lot of founders, I've seen it, and I also angel invest in other mostly female-founded startups, but I've seen it happen to others, and I've done it myself. So it's a very common thing because you want to make something work. You invest time, you invest money, you're in a relationship or you're working with a vendor or whatever's going on. You have a sunk cost of your time and money that you've put into something, right? And in your head, you're saying, I'm going to make this work. If I spend more time here, if I live down here, if I am here every single day, I can make this work. And sometimes what you have to realize is that no amount of effort that you put in is going to make it work how you want it to. And the sooner that you realize that, even if you have to walk away from a loss in money, the sooner that you can pivot into something that can work. And so we lost hundreds of thousands of dollars on our first manufacturing partner. And this was early days and it was painful. I mean, kept me up at night. And we should have pulled out from them 3 months prior.
What were the signs that you wish you had known about that would have led you to make this decision earlier?
It was really truly the quality of the product. So the quality of the product coming off the line wasn't at the level that we were comfortable selling to our customers. We create a premium, better fitting bra with really high quality materials. And that is what our promise to our customer was. So the product coming off the line, we couldn't sell because I wouldn't sell something that wasn't at the quality level that we wanted. And you have 100,000 bras and you can't sell them. And in my mind, I was thinking, well, maybe the next batch is going to be better. But how many times do you do that, right? How many chances do you give somebody? And I think writing was on the wall where we were not seeing improvements that we needed to. And we should have walked away sooner. And I couldn't make that decision. It was really, really hard. And it's really hard to kind of pull that Band-Aid off and also admit to your company and your investors that you've made a mistake. I picked the wrong manufacturing partner. That sucks. It sucks to say that. It sucks to be in that position. And then once you do that and walk away and lose money and, move to a different manufacturing partner who's amazing, who's delivering the quality you want, you in your mind, you're like, wow, I just wish I would have done that sooner. And the other thing that you realize is that it's okay to make mistakes. That's what you do as a founder. Let's totally be honest. Generally, what you do is hopefully you make good decisions 80% of the time. 20% of the time, your decisions are going to be wrong. You're going to make the wrong decision. You're going to regret something. That's okay. Just admit it, learn from it, move on. It's the same thing that we tell our teams all the time at Third Love. It's okay to make mistakes. Just don't do the same thing again. Like, what did you learn? Let's not do it again. And tomorrow's a new day. Nobody has time to focus on the past. And so I think there's this, wanting to like save face and seem like you're not making mistakes and this and that. And it's okay. It's okay to make mistakes. People actually, investors kind of expect it. That's what they know. They know that's going to happen to you. They've seen this before. They invest in hundreds of companies. You're not unique.
Well, and also to some extent, it builds your moat, for lack of a better word, because you've made those mistakes. And anyone who's out there, maybe trying to copy what you're doing is probably going to have to deal with those mistakes. And you've made them first. You know what it's like.
Totally. Yep.
What you're saying just in general about manufacturing is like, I feel your pain. And it's what, when we started Lumi, it was exactly the problem that we were trying to solve. Because when my co-founder and I ran our previous company, we lost a lot of money on packaging, making mistakes. And so we wanted to solve that problem, but not just for ourselves, solve it for a lot of other people too. And one of the things that's so hard, whatever you're trying to source from a manufacturing standpoint, is you only have one data point. You have like Correct. Your experience with that one, and you can hear from other people and people give you recommendations like this worked well for me or that worked well for me. But in the end, you have a keyhole perspective on the whole thing, because in the end you choose one manufacturing partner and it either works or doesn't. Like, how did you guys go about solving that then in the future iterations of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the one benefit that we had, the silver lining of the whole situation, was we had actually sourced a lot of the raw materials ourselves. So specifically, I mean the underwire, the material, the cup. And so there was a lot of things that we took with us, learnings and relationships that we brought with us to our next manufacturing partner. Also, as we all know, the second time you do anything, you understand what you're getting into. You know how to run a process better. You know how to onboard better. You know how to monitor and QC and do all these things that the first time are very much a learning. And so you take all that, you put it together, you're just much smarter. You can move more quickly. And so it just all came together in a way that scaled and created what we had set out to create the second time around. So it took more than one time. And thank God we had the money to do it. Because otherwise, I wouldn't be here today. You know, we had the money to be able to lose a little bit and move on and try again.
So lately, you've been starting to design and launch the extended sizes for Third Love. What does that mean? How did you decide to go into that area?
Yeah, when we started out, we've always had more sizes than other brands because of the half cups. So currently, as of last year, we went from a double A through a G cup, which is a pretty large size range, and then all the half cups in between. But through the Fit Finder in particular, going back to data, there was many women who were wanting to complete Fit Finder who had a size that was outside of the range that we offered. So obviously we collect a lot of data, we collect their email, we collect, their size. And what we found was there was a massive amount of women in that we were not serving. And so we set out to create more sizes to serve more women. And we beta tested 16 additional sizes last year in 2017, in the fall. And we sold through 30,000 units in a week. And we were just blown away by the response to these new sizes. And so we're about to relaunch those. And it's super exciting for our business because we truly want to have a bra for every single woman, regardless of size and shape. And so this is another step for us to be able to deliver that and service more women, which is really, really exciting.
I assume that in terms of breast shapes and sizes, there's some sort of bell curve, right? There's got to be some things that are more common than others. How do you deal with that from a supply chain and inventory perspective?
Great question. But one thing I would like to point out is that I think people think there's a bell curve with bra sizes, but we've found is there actually isn't.
I'm happy to be wrong about that. That's great.
Yeah. I mean, because I think it's the reason there's this misinformed idea that there is that there's common sizes that manufacturers produce. And they're common sizes that are stocked in store. And many women are put into most women, and I was one of them, are put into one of these common sizes because that's what's in stock, right? It's sort of the chicken and the egg. So then you end up with this bra that doesn't really quite fit in a size that's not right for you. And you don't really know it, or maybe you know it, but that's just how it is. And so what we found is that we really focus on helping a woman find the right size. And if we don't offer that size, we would never put you into another size, right? If we don't have it, we just say, we're working on it. We're going to come out with it at some point, and here's your size. And so my goal is really to help all women identify their correct size. That's the most important piece. Now for us, we have over 60 sizes. When we launch these extended sizes, we'll have close to 80. So it's a massive amount of sizes. But the benefit is we're e-commerce, obviously. We're 100% direct to consumer. And it's not difficult to stock bras. They're small and they don't take up a lot of space. And it honestly doesn't matter how many sizes we have. And we have very quick turn manufacturing. So we're constantly feeding data back into our inventory planning system so that we can be creating and producing the sizes that are needed the most. So it's more of a real-time model, and it's worked really well for us.
This might be a dumb question, but is part of it because everything is handmade that there's maybe like less of an economy of scale there? You can, I guess, make smaller runs of bras than maybe other products?
We do not make small runs. We absolutely don't, because it's exactly what you said. It's not beneficial. But we're at a scale where we sell millions of bras. We can buy, enough of each size to make it work. And our business is driven by a lot of basic colors. So it's not as much of a fashion business where there's inherent risk in not selling something. So if we buy something, we know that at some point it will sell, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Another point about sort of inclusivity, not just size-wise, but in terms of the brand and how you represent people, I think that you guys have done an incredible job with that in just in terms of being very inclusive in the way that you portray the people who are wearing your bras. Like, how do you guys think about that from a marketing and branding and, I don't know, messaging standpoint?
Yeah, we are a brand for a modern woman. And one of my, you know, one of my pain points personally when I started this company was, and I'm embarrassed to say it, I was in my early 30s still shopping at Victoria's Secret. I'm like, why am I shopping here? This imagery, the store, the smell of perfume, the pink bag, like nothing about it resonates. Nothing. The angels, the wings, the everything, the rhinestones. I mean, it's not me. And when I started looking at the landscape, there was no brand that resonated with me at all in the bra space. You have sort of the legacy, kind of bigger, more traditional brands that are sold in department stores. And then there's Victoria's Secret. That's pretty much what's out there. And the marketing, all of it is so antiquated. And the use of sex and sexual and innuendos is so over the top and has been done for so long. It's like, can't we do something different? And let's market to women. When you're buying a bra, you want to know it's comfortable, that it's going to fit you, that it's going to be beautiful. That's what you want to know. And so we created a brand and photography and a website and imagery and content that resonates with the modern woman. She's educated. She cares about how the bra is made, why we do it the way it is, what size works for her. And we spend a ton of time like thinking about that every single day and creating content that really can help educate and engage our customer.
Yeah. I think it's interesting because even as someone who doesn't shop at Victoria's Secret, I just from looking at the advertisements, I feel like it seems offensive even to me sometimes. So yeah.
It's the same thing that was done 20 years ago and the world's evolved and we need to evolve with it. We need to create better products for customers. We need to have marketing that's more in line with, you know, our customer base. And it doesn't work. And so, you know, it's created a huge opportunity for us to do something really different. So our models are different shapes and sizes. They're different ethnicities. And we really, really focus on diversity in both shape, size, shade, et cetera. Another thing is that our models are not sitting in promiscuous poses. You don't see, you know, two women in a pillow fight. Like that doesn't happen, you know? So these like weird setups of women hanging out with other women in lingerie. It's not daily life. So we show women what they really do in a bra, which is they're getting ready for work. They're drinking a cup of coffee. Maybe they have their robe on and they're sitting on the couch reading the paper. You know, there's these moments in time where you're getting dressed in your bra and underwear. And that's what we portray. It's supposed to be real life, right? It's how real women live and how their bra and underwear is incorporated into their daily actions and what they do every day.
I actually have a friend who has recently been transitioning to basically identifying as a female and for the first time is buying bras. And it's like, It's probably not a large proportion of your customers, but there's a certain, why not? You know, like why not open yourself up to the reality, which is that humans are all pretty different and have different outlooks on things. Why do we all have to conform to a specific idea of sexuality or what someone looks like?
Absolutely. Yeah, no, and every individual is unique. And so that's part of, you know, Third Love. It's the uniqueness of every person, every customer, and having an openness to allowing everybody in. It's an inclusive brand. You know, other brands are exclusive because they don't carry a certain size or they don't showcase people in a certain way. There's only one way. And so we really strive to be inclusive and to bring everyone into the fold. And I think that's really exciting.
Where does the name Third Love come from?
So three things you love about your favorite items of clothing. You love the style, you love the feel, and love the fit. So those are the three loves we think about designing every single product.
That's pretty cool. I didn't know that. One last thing before we wrap up. You said that you're building a showroom. What is that going to be all about?
So still up in the air a bit, to be honest. But yeah, we just signed a lease on a 30,000 square foot space in San Francisco. Yeah, three floors, beautiful building. And on the first floor, we're going to have a retail space slash showroom. So we're really kind of thinking through what might that look like for us. It's our first foray into really having a small retail presence. And it'll be like a lab for us where we can test and iterate different things. But what I'm excited about is thinking through what a traditional bra shop looks like when you walk in, which is not overly compelling, especially a department store experience, and thinking through how we can set it up in a really different way that's really welcoming and easy. And so that's something that's top of mind for us as we design the space.
Yeah, I'm excited to come visit. I can't wait to see how it all shapes up.
Can't wait to host you guys. Yeah.
Well, if people want to learn more about you and about Third Love, what should they do?
Go to thirdlove.com, and my email is Heidi at Third Love. So I always welcome feedback from anyone on our brand and products. So I love hearing from people. So always feel free to reach out.
I might send you some emails. You have lots of great insights. I really appreciate you sharing all of that with us. So yeah, go to thirdlove.com. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, if you got something useful out of it, I would love to hear what that was. Consider writing a short review, could be just a sentence long, by going to iTunes and searching for Well Made. I want to hear it all. I want to hear good, bad. I want to hear your constructive criticisms. I am just trying to make this show as useful as possible for you. So tell us what you think. That is the very best way that you can support the show. Thanks, and see you next time.